He's uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
Hello out there in cyberspace. The late 80s and early 90s were a golden age of free stuff on the internet. If you could afford the equipment and the access, you could find just about any piece of software you wanted, and also lots of pictures of naked people. The bulletin board system, or BBS, was the lifeblood of this freewheeling time, and it didn't last long. I'm Matthew Galt, and this is Cyber. Now this week, we are bringing you the story of Rusty and Edie's BBS, friendliest BBS in the world. And here to tell the tale is Motherboard staff writer Samantha Cole. It's the subject of her newest piece on the site, The Death of Rusty and Edie's, one of the horniest places on the 90s internet. Sam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me bring our music.
Love this music.
Yeah, it's nice, right? It's nice to be able to just throw it on at the push of a button. All right, I like to get really basic stuff out of the way first. Can you explain to the people at home who may not know, who aren't old like I am, what a BBS is or was?
So bulletin board systems were basically like the way people talk to each other on the internet before we had Twitter and Facebook and the nightmare that we have today. It was before like the World Wide Web. So it was all text based. The first one started in like 1978. It replaced like physical actual cork boards, like index cards punched into like bulletin boards, literal bulletin boards that you'd find in like public spaces. So you would dial into a BBS using software that was running on your computer, your house, or your office. And it would run through a modem and your telephone line and dial into a server, which was usually running in somebody else's house. And then people would like leave messages and post you know, news and gossip and about whatever was going on that day. And then also would share files, which it was like a big use of it. It was people sharing programs and different kinds of files.
So what was the culture like that kind of developed around this stuff? Who was using these BBS services at first, and who was running the stuff?
Yeah, I mean, the culture around it at first was very techie because that's who could access it. So the people who were using it were people who like had computers supplied to them by their offices, or who were like already working in like tech companies, or could afford like these multi-$1,000 systems, which is, you know, how much a computer to bring home cost, plus you'd have to buy like the modem and then hook yourself up to an internet service provider and all that good shit. So yeah, it was mostly people who were like really into the DIY kind of scene. They wanted to figure things out for themselves. And people used it, you know, like I said, like they use it just to like talk to other people locally a lot, because to dial on your phone long distance cost, you know, a lot of money, and it was by the minute. So there's a lot of local communities talking to each other.
All right. So who then are Rusty and Edie? I guess Rusty is kind of the driving force behind the BBS that they end up creating, right?
Yeah, Rusty was kind of the one who was really into it, by all accounts that I could find. So it was Russell and Edwina Hardenberg. They were this, you know, like couple in their 40s and 50s who were kind of tinkering around with this internet thing in the 80s. Most of what I could find firsthand accounts from them was just this archived post that Rusty is credited as writing, where he's explaining how all this came about. But, you know, I wasn't able to get a hold of them personally. They're in their 70s and 80s now, and they're kind of hard to reach. If anyone out there knows them or knows how to get in touch with them, I would love to talk to them. But what we know as far as what he apparently put out there was he bought a computer to help with his insurance business. He said it would, like, speed it up. It was a Tandy 1200. And he says it costs, I think it was, like, $3,000 or $4,000 to bring home. But he was super excited about connecting to BBSs and being able to like download shareware, which is software that people would upload and then make available to other people for free, usually legally, Usually it was like, you know, someone would make a piece of software and then share it. But sometimes not so legally, which is what got them in trouble down the line.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. We don't really see as much of this now. I guess you do on like websites, right? Websites that have kind of developed personal apps. But there was a pretty big, back in the 80s and 90s, there was a large community of shareware. Right. People would just make free software applications, sometimes for fun, just kind of put them online and they'd proliferate. And it created this ecosystem. And I remember this from when I was a kid, where if it was online, you kind of assumed you didn't have to pay for it. Right. You were paying so much already to even get to the point where you could see the software. Why would you ever pay someone a license for something?
Right. That was kind of the culture of the time. It was like, who knows what's legal and what's not. I think people knew, but it was such a wild west of stuff and sharing, and no one really was cut and dry on what was happening. And that's how you ended up with like the FBI seal, like you wouldn't steal a car before VHS tapes, like that kind of push against privacy is coming out of that era.
All right, so Russell decides that he wants to make his own BBS because he starts getting involved in stuff online and he kind of hates how it's set up. Can you explain like what it was like to try to get into some of these BBS services? They sound almost like private clubs with really esoteric and strange membership requirements.
That's a good way to describe it, actually. Yeah, a lot of them started that way. A lot of them kind of grew out of that and became much bigger, but like the accounts that we have of Rusty talking about why he got into it, he basically was like, I have to jump through too many hoops, so fuck it, I'm gonna like start my own. But the hoops that he had to jump through were basically other systems administrators and operators would usually ask people to like identify themselves or to call them personally, like pick up the phone and call them and say, hey, I want to connect to your BBS. Or they would make them answer a bunch of like weird questions and like fill out a questionnaire to like basically make them prove that they really wanted to get in. Even if the questions didn't have anything to do with what they were there to do. It was, some of them were like age gated in like this really old kind of archaic way. So they would pick up the phone and say, hey, I'm 18. I can access this adults only server. And then the SysOp would be like, you don't sound 18, so no. It was this really weird kind of like slapdash thing that was going on. And some of them charged a fee, so that's how you kind of set up like, okay, you need to mail me a check and then I can give you login information. So Rusty was like, I hate all of this. This is too complicated. Like, just let people access my BBS. It'll have no rules. This is all too annoying and hard, so I'm going to make my own and it'll be very open and people won't have to do all this extra stuff, which bit him in the ass in the end in a big way.
I have to ask about, I need to know if this was a rhetorical flourish of yours or if it's something you actually saw. You're right. He didn't understand what questionnaires asking about the name of his cat or his grandparents' political affiliation. Was that like literally stuff he was having to do? Like you'd have to tell people his cat's name?
Says that that's in that post that I found that was like, it's attributed to him and it's all over these like history sites about BBSs, like that is what he claims people were asking, like those are the kinds of things. I haven't seen that in any like other documentation, but I do know that like questionnaires were a thing and like having to fill out like your contact information and like where you lived and that you were a real person was a thing. So I believe it. This is like a like an I am not a robot type thing, but it's like, I am a human that is not a psycho. Not that your cat's name would prove anything.
Well, I love the idea of living in a world where the way you age gate check is you make someone call you.
Yeah.
Like there were that few users back then, right? That you could you could just do that. And also, like, I guess every user on a BBS was a stress on the system, right? It was costing whoever was running it a little bit more money. So there's incentives to kind of narrow it down. It's funny, the way Rusty makes it sound, it makes it sound like people were begrudgingly running these systems. Like, they got involved in it and weren't having fun anymore, but had to keep them up for whatever reason.
Yeah, that happened to a lot of people. People would get into it because they liked the technology and thought it was fun. And it was fun until they had, you know, like tens of thousands of callers who were emailing them hate mail, being like, why can't I get into your server?
Until you have to worry about moderation and keeping the customers happy. Jeez, it's, you know,
we all have fun and games until you have to be a mod.
Yeah, we won't see that repeated ad nauseum forever for the next 40 years, will we? So what was the motto of their BBS?
They wanted to be the friendliest BBS in the world. And also their second motto was no rules.
Where were they based again physically?
Boardman, Ohio.
It's so funny because you hear these things that you think of like shit posters putting up now, right? Mm-hmm. Like some of the worst people on the internet. And then you look at the picture of them and they're this kindly old couple. They look like they could be farmers. And they've got pictures of their cat warming itself on their servers.
Yeah, baby the cat. Who loved to lay on the servers.
Yeah, it's just wild that I haven't seen that juxtaposition of internet culture with that kind of person before. I think it's interesting.
Yeah, that's who was running stuff in the early days. It was that and like literal teenagers. Yeah.
Emily points out, as I said to Sam yesterday, we cannot judge what people look like in terms of freakiness, which is absolutely correct.
Judge a freak by their picture.
Because the friendliest place, the friendliest BBS out there was pretty freaky, right? There was a lot of pornography on it.
That's so the kind of after effect, obviously, of being the friendliest BBS in the world and like letting people come in and have no rules. Something that people could do on BBS is upload files. So of course people would come on there and upload like tons of porn, which happened on like, I would say most BBSs that didn't have like some kind of explicit ban rule against it. But it was full of porn. And that's kind of the reputation that it gained because you know, even now we'll see people saying, oh, I remember Rusty and Eddie's because the porn that I saw in the 90s was like tagged and watermarked with their name. So what went on there got around for sure. And it was a lot of nudes.
What did, were people just uploading like scans of Playboy or like what did the porn look like in the early internet? I also saw there were animated GIFs.
So when people say GIFs at that time, they're talking about still GIF usually.
Okay.
So just the file type was just GIFs, but they weren't like animating. Usually, I don't think that would be a huge file at the time. So you couldn't just like in like the late 80s when they were really getting popular, you couldn't just like open a browser and type in boobs or whatever. Like there wasn't a browser. The World Wide Web wasn't a thing yet, or at least not for like majority of people. So everything was text-based. So you'd have, binary files that people could see like the file name and the description of what was inside, but you wouldn't be able to really see what you were downloading until you downloaded the file. So like people would joke name things and then you would thinking it was like it would be like tied up bitch or something. Sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on here, but and then you would download the file thinking it was like BDSM or something and it was like a dog. So a lot of that going around, but a lot of porn files lived on these BBSs and people were just kind of uploading and downloading based on what they could read, and that got a lot of people in trouble because a lot of it was, you know, inaccurate and saying things that weren't really on there, but most of it was, you know, explicitly posting porn. And that's why people kept paying for these subscriptions for these things. They weren't just there for like the news. They were there to trade, you know, scanned in Playboys, which is exactly what you said. That's a big part of what was on there was things that people would copy from magazines.
Chatter Prawn Lord points out that a lot of this early stuff was ASCII art too.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. A ton of that. Yeah. So ASCII?
I don't know. I've always said ASCII. I don't know. You know, I've never typed it. I've always typed it and never said it. So I don't really know.
Yeah. However you say that, ASCII art was, text-based also. So you would have, people assembling characters to look like boobs or whatever. Like they would, it's an incredible art like style. I think it's really cool, but you would use the limited numbers you have available to you, characters on your keyboard, to create like this mosaic line by line. And a lot of it was also porn. The internet's always been for porn. So
yeah, of course. Another thing that strikes me is, did they watermark everything that went through? Like, how does that happen?
I'm not really clear on that either. I mean, so the point of that would be to get more advertising for your BBS. And because they did grow enough that they eventually were selling subscriptions for $89 a year, which is a lot for 1989, 90, 91. They would want more people to see what was going on in their BBS and then come there and pay for a subscription. So that's the only reason I can think of why people would be doing that. Whether or not they obviously did it because people said that people remember. Did I turn off my, you still seeing me?
I turned off my camera. We lost your camera there briefly.
Oh, weird. Still on.
It's coming back now.
I hit my space bar. Turned off.
Strange. I think that's a Discord thing, actually.
Oh, Discord. So that's the only reason I can think of where people would watermark porn that isn't theirs, because at that point you're just saying like I obviously didn't take this picture of this extremely famous Playboy bunny.
So
but I'm gonna put my name on it.
So are Rusty and Edie turning a profit then?
I can't say whether they were turning a profit because the operation had to be expensive. If you look on the site, I think there's a picture. I think the lead picture is in the background is all of their setup, like their servers and the computers and all of that. It was so hot in there that they had to like buy like a 4-ton air conditioner and like a humidifier. And like they were burning a lot of electricity just keeping this thing going. So the electric bill alone, I don't know, like maybe they were breaking even. Whether or not they were like getting rich off it, I really kind of doubt, but I could be wrong. I think they just did it because they got way in over their heads.
So I mean, there's more demand. So you just kind of start chasing your tail. He enjoys what he's doing and it just kind of snowballs. Right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So at the same time that the BBS is growing, they're becoming more popular, there's kind of this other force that's starting to rise where, the government is starting to figure out that people are doing things online that they don't like, basically. Can we talk about, like, what kind of is the background on that side of things and, like, what are the conditions that give rise to Rusty and Edie going down?
Yeah, so simultaneously with them getting big, and a lot of others were getting big, they weren't the biggest. There was probably 5 or 6 others that were really big. When I say big, I mean like in the tens of thousands of callers. So when they were getting really popular, software makers were starting to get really kind of pissy about their work being spread online as shareware, which obviously they were catching on. People like Microsoft and Adobe and these companies that they did not like seeing their work spread online. So you had the Software Publishers Association, which is now I think called the Software and Information Industry Association, was this really powerful trade organization that was lobbying for new laws around piracy and copyright. And all this stuff was coming up for the first time because the internet was pretty new. So they successfully lobbied Congress into making software piracy a felony in October 1992. So it's just a couple months before these went down. So at that point, making 10 or more copies of a piece of software within 6 months would be punishable by 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. And then it kind of goes up from there, second offenses. So there was this huge push for like the FBI to get involved and for this to become really serious crime. Heresy.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So what is the story of the specific piece of software that kind of brings them down? I thought was really funny and bizarre. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So this is based on a report I found in an old issue of Boardwatch magazine, which is an incredible magazine devoted to bulletin boards. that report attributes to, they talked to a guy who said that he had made this home design software, this CAD software, and was like trying to make his like living off of the royalties from it. He was selling for like $14 or something, and then he was getting royalties. But then he found it people downloading it for free on this BBS called Exec PC. So he contacted that SysOp and said, "Hey, can you check this down?" And that guy was like, "Yeah, but you know, there's a file in here that says it came from Rusty and Edie's BBS." Again, they were, for some reason,
that damn watermark.
They're putting their name on everything. And so the software guy was like, "Okay, fine." And so he went and contacted Rusty, and he says that Rusty was like, "No, fuck off. I'll get to it when I get to it. This is not important to me. I have so much else to do." So that guy, the software guy, was like, "Fine." And he called the FBI, which is a wild reaction, I think, but to go straight to the feds and to be like,
hey. The 90s was a different time, right? And this was, you think about like, this was the Wild West of this stuff. Yeah. Like we were saying, who do you go to adjudicate this kind of thing? I guess the FBI, right? Like who else do you call?
The FBI, 911 FBI. I don't know. I love that. I hate that. But like, what if you could just be like, "I saw it tweeted," and like,
right.
I'm calling
one day. I like that you describe the gentleman's life story as pastoral too. He was literally like building a home out on the farm somewhere.
He was literally farming. He was like trying to retire into like this life of farming. He like made his software, his home design software, and he was like, "Okay, I'm going to live off that forever. This is my nest egg."
Not anymore. Not with Rusty and Edie around.
Not if Rusty has anything to do with it.
Okay, so what? Well, they raid the friendliest BBS, right? Like what does this look like?
I mean, the things that I've read said that they went in there and took everything out. Like it was just, they went in and took out all of their servers and all their machines. I actually emailed the FBI and I was like, "Hey, can you tell me anything about this case that happened, you know, 29 years ago?" And they replied and said, "We can confirm nor deny the existence of any investigation." And I was like, it's been almost 30 years, but, and there's like a ton of like actual news stories about this happening, but okay. So the FBI doesn't want to talk about it, but so they showed up and they took everything out. And then kind of the fallout to that was all of these trade magazines like PC Magazine and Computer World and Boardwatch were freaking out. And then people were posting on like Usenet, which is another text-based communication system that was happening at the time. People were passing along the news there and saying, "What's this mean for the rest of us? You know, if one of the biggest can go down, the rest of us kind of fucked." So, yeah.
And I just want to throw this little bit of history in there, because I saw in the copy of Boardwatch magazine, we also have Steve Jackson versus the Secret Service. BBS operator fights back with $2 million lawsuit. Do you know that story by chance? You ever heard
of it? I don't. I need to read that. I should read that whole issue of Boardwatch, actually.
So it kind of dovetails into what we're talking about here. So Steve Jackson Games was a games company out of Austin. They did a lot of stuff that was like playing around with the Illuminati and like conspiracy theories and like kind of games based around that. I played a lot of that stuff growing up. And they also invented a thing called GURPS, which is like a generic universal role-playing system, which is like an easy to use role-playing system that people could slot in whatever they wanted to. They were working on a cyberpunk GURPS. And the guy that had written it was running his own BBS and had written this cyberpunk book for them and was running a BBS that they would like trade Frack magazine and talk about cybercrime, but they weren't involved in it. So he was doing research for this cyberpunk book that he's going to put out. Well, one day, in, I believe 1991, the Secret Service raids Steve Jackson Games. Literally, like, bust down the door. There's reports that the agents were eating like jelly beans off of people's desks, and they seize the finalized copy of the GURPS cyberpunk book and say that it is a cybercrime manual, and then take them to court. And then Steve Jackson pushes back, and the like kind of people that coalesce around him become the EFF. Like, that was the first EFF case, was them fighting back on behalf of this games company.
I do know this story. Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah, so it was just really funny to see, like, Rusty and Edie's BBS thing happening, getting seized by the FBI right after Steve Jackson and the Secret Service thing. Like, it's interesting to watch, like, all of this, the kind of the legislative work starting to happen, like these fights beginning to happen in the early 90s, right?
Yeah, that's so funny. I've seen like the Steve Jackson Games thing come up in like literature, like the history of EFF, but I never like really dug into what happened there.
It was really bizarre because it was just like a silly little games company in Austin. And then one day like Secret Service agents kicked down your door, right?
Yeah.
Can't even send the FBI.
The fact that they would go after these small operations, I don't know. Like, I mean, this is still happening.
Yeah, right. But,
like, it's just a long legacy of bullshit. But yeah, to make an example of like these kind of like passion projects is wild.
So what happened? Well, and it's funny you kind of bring up in your piece how something like this couldn't quite happen today, right? Because there's laws that protect the people running the site, right? Can you kind of get into that?
Yeah, I mean, a couple years later, the Communications Decency Act came along, and then Section 230, which shields platforms from liability for what users do on them. So it would be a lot harder to kind of have like a takedown like this today, because like, you know, it would be like taking down Facebook because people were posting copyrighted stuff. It would just be, would not be done. It would be a different situation today. Nowadays, you would go after, I think, individuals. The federal punishment for piracy, I think, is still the same. I think it's still 5 years and $250,000. But yeah, it's definitely different times that they were in at the time. And that's why it made it also very weird. You know, mods were making these really strange decisions about like trying to figure out what was and wasn't copyrighted. There was kind of like, if it looks too nice, if it looks too slick, it's probably copyrighted. If it's like the model is like too hot, basically is what one operator said. He was like, if the model looks too put together, it's probably not like an amateur using our BBS. It's probably someone uploading Playboy or Hustler or whatever. I'll just kind of like fly by hunches. All this was like way boring, that stuff.
I really wish I could find the quote in here, but I thought that was a really funny quote where the guy was like, yeah, if it's a professional model and everything looks too clean, I just don't accept it anymore because I don't want the trouble.
Yeah. Oh, I'm going to bring it up right now. He said, if the photo showed beautiful women that were so absolutely gorgeous, and the photography was beautiful and there were no blemishes on their skin and the lighting was perfect, we took it off. Took the file off their BBS because it was probably not something that someone owned. And that's a quote from this book, which is an old book, Obscene Prophets, that everyone should read. My plug for a book from the 90s.
Can I also ask you about this case in Memphis, Tennessee, where am I reading this correctly? And I've got it pulled up here, where they got people on child pornography charges after the feds had uploaded the child pornography to the website?
Yeah, so that is actually a really important landmark case that I could have written and have written many, many more words on. So Robert and Carlene Thomas ran Amateur Action BBS, and that was probably maybe the biggest, if not one of the biggest BBSs at the time, because it was specifically devoted to porn. Someone like claimed that had child porn on there and tipped off the feds again. And then the assistant U.S. attorney in Tennessee kind of looked into it, and a postal inspector downloaded a bunch of stuff from the BBS, you know, logged on as someone else, ordered a bunch of tapes through the mail. Basically did as much as he could to like make it some crimes. And then he uploaded child porn to that BBS. So he planted it. He didn't find anybody, planted them. And then they were indicted in Tennessee because Tennessee had stricter obscenity laws than California, which is where they were running. So it was all kind of this huge scheme to take down this huge porn BBS, but they indicted in Tennessee on 12 counts of violation of obscenity laws, and then child porn count was dropped because what a like farce,
right?
But they still served, you know, I think it was like a couple of years in the pen, which is crazy. Like, it's such a crazy story.
Well, it's funny too. You mentioned ordered some videotapes through the mail. Again, we just don't have any memory of. That used to be extremely illegal, right?
Yeah, like transporting obscene materials over like state lines was
a federal offense, you know, and through the mail. Yeah, using the mail to distribute pornography was a federal offense in the 90s.
Yeah, and then they were trying to figure out how to like make it a crime on the internet too, because it's like, okay, we're going across state lines naturally because of the internet. So how can we make this as worst crime we possibly can by taking this California-based server and accessing it from Tennessee? Has worse strict obscenity laws. Luckily, we're on all of that. So.
J-Dews asks, that was the Larry Flint case, right? I think his was more related to actual physical pornography, like, right? It wasn't internet-based stuff.
Yeah, I think so. That was a separate case, though.
Yeah.
Similar.
All right, let's loop it back into Rusty and Edie real quick here. How do you think all of this shaped the internet that we live in now?
That is a good question. I mean, I think that I think that era is so interesting to kind of study and learn from because we haven't learned anything. Like, a lot of the moderation problems of pre-web internet have not gone away. I would say none of them have gone away. They've gotten worse. But, you know, at least people are more well-versed on what is and isn't okay to steal. Sort of. People have gotten smarter about it, maybe. Back then it was like, oh, it's digital, so it can't be stealing. I mean, how it's shaped how we are online today, I would say it all was kind of that we're dealing with the bedrock problems that we deal with today in moderation, you know, like getting too big for like a few mods to handle, you know, these problems of scale, you know, things like what is and isn't allowed for users to upload, what you're okay with people putting on your site. Like terms of service started back then because you couldn't just have people uploading whatever they wanted onto a site. You would end up with, you know, child sexual abuse material on your site, which nobody wanted. So you would have to have these terms laid out so that you could then say, I'm going to ban you because you broke these rules that you read before you showed up to my VBS, which a lot of VBSs had really strict rules. So a lot of that was really laid out really early, but we haven't solved a lot of the problems. They've just gotten bigger, more complicated, which is a bleak outlook, but I think it's interesting to kind of to read about that time and say, like, nothing really changes, like nothing new under the sun, as long as humans are still humans and using the internet, it's all the same.
And what became of Rusty and Edie?
I don't totally know, honestly. They were sued by Playboy the same year that they were raided. So there was a big Playboy lawsuit against them, and they settled. They reached a settlement. They tried to restart things after the raid and after the Playboy thing. They started got on the web, which was just starting. They got a website. But which you can go to, I think it's linked in the story. You can go to the Wayback Machine, the archive version of that website. It's just a little login box like it would have been back then, but didn't go anywhere. Like, they just kind of fizzled out by then. As far as what they're up to now, I don't know.
Just another unsolved mystery of the early internet. And yeah, we've got their little site pulled up. Rusty and Edie's web VBS, yeah. The cute little owls and kind of nothing going on.
There's a sign in at their old address, which is now like a little strip mall, but there's a sign that says home of R&E Center, home of Rusty and Edie's. Yes. Yeah. So cute.
Adorable.
And it's got the little owls on it. Anyone's from Ohio and can drive by there, we know. I want to know if it's still there.
All right, Sam, thank you so much for coming on to Cyber and walking us through this. I'm going to hit the outro music. Where can people find your work, and what else are you working on right now?
On Motherboard. I am working on a book, which is coming out in the fall.
Excellent. And
a lot of it is about this stuff.
Perfect.
Wait, you can find me on Twitter.
Yes.
Really cool.
And I am at MJ Galt on Twitter and Cyber. We'll be back next week again at roughly 4 p.m. Eastern here on Twitch. If you missed the beginning of this broadcast, you can catch it as a podcast tomorrow, probably around 11-ish. And we will be back next week with more exciting stories about cyber and cybersecurity. I'm going to be looking at talking about cyber war, I think, in the near future. There may be a lot more cyber also in the near future, but stay tuned for that. And see you all next week. Bye-bye.
How does appreciation feel to you? A rising rush of warmth? A building wave of confidence? At Reward Gateway Edenred, we know appreciation appreciates in value. Starting with people, radiating through companies to transform their performance and productivity. Capture the power of appreciation with our Total Employee Experience Platform.